It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Tom Barrett, a longtime Trump associate, was involved in his inaugural stuff. Kind of a confidant kind of thing. Arrested, we talked about this the other day, arrested for lobbying Trump for the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. Posted bond, actually got out quarter of $1 billion. Kind of serious. You're looking at $250 million. Now, he secured it with $5 million cash. But the rest of it, $250 million if he doesn't show up, which, again, would still be chump change for Barrett if he chooses to go on the run, which, you know, as I'm reading about this, probably his best option. Bailing probably his best option. Now they've got some restrictions on him. He can't transfer any funds overseas. He can't travel outside of Southern California and New York. He's going to have a curfew. Also, he's going to have to wear one of the GPS monitoring systems to make sure that he is being tracked. Now, this guy's a really wealthy guy. I'm expecting flight. We will see. It's beginning. We'll see the former guy, how many people around him end up in jail and how many of them get thrown under the bus. I'm sitting back waiting for all of these perp walks to begin because, you know, Michael Cohen, the former fixer, came out recently and said he already thinks that Jared Kushner is flipped. So if that happens, you know, the Wonder Boy flips, they're all going down. And it's going to make for an interesting marriage. But I guarantee he's going to do everything he can do to keep himself out of jail. The other big news today, the Cleveland Indians have changed their names. At the beginning of next season, they will be known as the Guardians. I'm not a big fan of the name, but it is what it is. I'm neither happy nor upset at the name change. Things happen. Things change. I'm okay with it. I guess they'll be the G-Men from now on. Interesting enough that a guy running for Senate in Ohio, Josh Mandel, didn't actually understand that there was the Guardian name was actually tied to the city in a certain way. Because on the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge, or I think the official name is the Hope Memorial Bridge, which nobody ever calls it. That's the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge. It brings the east side and the west side together downtown. There are these pillars, these statues. They are the guardians of traffic. I didn't make up the name. The people who did it did. And there is some heritage there, I guess, that you can use. I personally liked the buzzards. Anyone who grew up in Cleveland, especially who's my age, knows that the popular radio station at the time, they're, you know, home of the Buzzards, WMMS, they have this big festival every year. I think that would have been a good name as far as I'm concerned. But it is what it is. It'll go forward in a couple of years. We'll forget it. But the former guy losing his ever-loving freaking mind, actually on Save America letterhead. He went off on this whole spiel about, as a former baseball fan, you know, he's angry. You can't believe they changed the name. You know the spiel. You know how the tantrum goes. And look, I've heard and seen it a bunch. I really have. You know, look, I was born and raised in Cleveland. I spent a good portion of my life there. I have no vested interest in the name. But, you know, I saw people today, you know, on social media losing their minds over, I can't believe this is crazy, like the former guy. And then people on the other side, oh, I've been waiting for this day my whole life. Really? Do you have nothing better to do? And now look, if you're part of the Native American community, okay, I can see that. But a white girl from the suburbs, I'm sorry. This way too much invested in this kind of woke mentality. Just my thoughts. But they will be the G-men next year, and it will be what it is, and baseball will go on. And look, it'll be a whole new merchandising thing. It'll be a whole new. And think of all of those old T-shirts that you got laying around with Chief Wahoo on it. They're going to be collector's items, and you'll be able to get Trump supporters to part with some of their money to get it from you. Upsides to everything. But it is Friday Wingnut Weekend Review, and boy, what a week it was. What a week of crazy we saw. Actually, one of my favorite bits was Sean Hannity, who asked if Joe Biden had planned to kiss the behind of every single solitary dictator in the world. And did it. This is the amazing part to me. Did it with a straight face. Now, look, the former guy literally said that him and Kim Jong-un were trading love letters. Remember that? They were in love. He went on for like an hour over that during one of the spiels. The Helsinki thing? Really? I don't know how you do it, but good on... This is where, again, I give conservatives credit. They've got historical amnesia. They can easily forget what happened yesterday and have a new reality. You know, alternative facts, alternative history, alternative realities, they're all in. They are the party of Winston Smith. They are the party of well, that didn't happen the way you remember it yesterday, even though it did. I give them credit for that. I mean, but my thought is, if you have that ability to forget what happened yesterday, why are you always so mad? You know, why are they so ticked off? It's crazy. Florida, one of my favorite places now, going to be a blue state soon. They keep killing off Republicans at the rate that they're going. Maybe going to be a blue state soon. You've got their governor flip-flopping back and forth. Again, love that. They were going to stay the course. Now, well, maybe we might think about someone possibly, you know, talking about a mask somewhere, maybe. And you got the Senator Rick Scott, former governor. As cases are going through the roof, as Florida accounting for, well, Florida, Missouri, Texas account for 40% of all new cases, and Florida is half of all of that. You got Rick Scott saying, we've met every single goal to beat back the virus. It's clear that America has beaten COVID. Anybody believing that? Anybody buying that? I mean, seriously, I mean, I look at someone like Rick Scott and I go, you know, the guy's kind of a kook. Probably should be in jail from some of his antics around Medicare. But, you know, he probably paid enough people. He's got enough money to get out of it. It is what it is. But to come out and say that we've beaten it at a time when your state is literally exploding, and some of the projections that I see are pretty scary. I have a listener who spends a lot of time meticulously, you know, going through these models, and what he's shared with me, scary stuff. You know, we're talking thousands of people a day because you've got people who just, I'm not going to get vaccinated. No, not me. Not going to do it. You know, even as you've got the governor of Alabama who is completely, you know, just flummoxed over the fact that they can't get people to get vaccinated. She is literally doing everything she can think of. And she came out and she said the other day, she said, it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks. And I'm going, really? Who are the regular folks in Alabama? Because Alabama is one of the least vaccinated states in the country. But she said, she doubled down saying, it's the unvaccinated folks who are letting us down. And truthfully, the unvaccinated folks, they don't seem to care. There was just a recent poll came out, and they're talking about the people who, you know, aren't going to get vaccinated. And the numbers of these people are staggering because, well, they don't believe it works. I mean, every excuse you can come up with. Well, you know, it's not going to work against the variant. I've heard, you know, it's all a hoax. It's crazy. But what they came out with is this new AP NORC poll found that close to 9 in 10 unvaccinated people are at least somewhat somewhat confident that the COVID-19 vaccines will be effective against the variants. Only about a third of unvaccinated say the same. So 9 out of 10 vaccinated people think that, hey, we're going to be okay with the variants coming through. We got some protection, might be okay. Only 3 in 10 people who are unvaccinated. That's what the numbers are. It's crazy. And, you know, how they go through and they looked at this, and I'm going, now the numbers are pretty overwhelming. We hear doctors saying, look, you know, the people who are in our ICUs, these are people who haven't been vaccinated. They're telling these stories of people coming in and on their deathbed asking for the vaccine because, oh, I thought it was a hoax or whatever. And that isn't enough. Now, look, I'm struggling with the idea of you know, mandates. I think this can't, and this is where I agree with Frank Luntz in his focus group tests, that, you know, maybe the way to do this is you just have, you know, individual businesses and you know, concert venues and everywhere say, look, if you've, you know, you're not vaccinated, you're not getting in. Make it that there's public pressure involved. The problem with that is we tried that and we ended up seeing people get shot and killed over it. So again, we're in this weird spot where the dim, they're dragging everyone else down. And this is where the governor of Alabama is right. The unvaccinated people are dragging us down. But there's no way I see that we can mandate that people are going to go get the vaccines other than it has to get bad again. And I got to wonder if that's even enough. If it's even enough to get them to go, well, you know, it's getting bad. Maybe we should. So that was fun. Also, on the money side of COVID, you've got Republican officials in Michigan who have taken, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in the relief money, the rescue money from the federal government. And, well, they gave themselves bonuses. Now, these are people who should be perp walked right into court, tried, convicted, and jailed for this. And I hope they do, because we've already seen cases of people abusing the system, getting nabbed up and locked up. So I'm hoping for them. I'm hoping to see them get thrown away. Maybe they can start a pack, a defense pack, or maybe stupid people will send them a bunch of money. Because this week we find out from FEC filings that the Trump leadership pack has raised $75 million the first half of 2021 with the goal of stopping the steal. And so far they've spent exactly zero. Again, I said from the beginning this was a ripoff. This was going to be graft. This was going to be them putting money in their pockets. And it's exactly what the former guy did. And I'll be interested to see what the Department of Justice does. This seems kind of fraudulent. Going to be interesting to see how it goes. Another fun day with the right wing, angry white guys. Self-described Trump guy. He was sentenced to 20 days in jail after he was. This is one of those things where you go, I don't know what it is about conservative white guys, because we saw on Insurrection Day someone taking a dump in the hallway and on someone's desk. Well, evidently this guy has been taking a dump on his neighbor's lawn a couple of times, and this is what's getting him 20 days in jail. I'm going, what is it that makes conservatives think? That sounds like a good idea. I guess it's the same thing that makes them think, yeah, Trump was a good idea. That's all I can come up with. But yeah, hey, fun with conservatism. And also some fun coming up in the very near future. Remember the Obama years? Remember every time that the debt ceiling was coming around, that we'd have to raise the debt ceiling because we spent some money? And Republicans held the nation hostage. You know, every time we had this ticking bomb, it was down to the last minute. Any minute now, the country's going to default on all it owes, and the economy's going to tank. And there were these doomsday scenarios, and how everything was going to stop, and our credit was going to go through the floor, and the rates were going to go up, and our debt was going to double. It was all these doomsday scenarios, and eventually, Democrats did cave and give what Republicans wanted on the screw quester. which again ended up harming us in multiple ways. Think Benghazi. But, you know, they still got their exacted their pound of flesh. Well, get ready for it again, because Mitch McConnell has already said there's not going to be one Republican who's going to vote to raise the debt ceiling. And now you've got Janet Yellen today telling Congress that she's going to start taking emergency measures to make sure that we don't default, that she will keep the country from an unprecedented default on the national debt. She said, you know, like we heard all during the Obama years, a default would cause irreparable harm to our economy, the livelihoods of Americans, and, well, it would screw over the globe. We could start some really, really negative stuff. But chaos and things burning to the ground, that seems to be the GOP way. It's the show, right? Because this week we got treated to front row seats to the WWGOP as they did their very predictable stunt around the select committee that's going to begin next Tuesday. You know, you knew that Kevin McCarthy was going to put Jim Jordan on that committee. You knew it. Now, I personally think Nancy Pelosi made the wrong decision, and I've been taking a beating for that all along. I'm a believer in more speech than less. I would rather have him there and being hammered than to allow them to go off and have their own kangaroo court, which is what they've already said they're going to do. So next week should be lots of fun. If you think Wingnut Week in Review was fun this week, wait till next week when the WWGOP comes out in full costume, they've got their dress rehearsal already done, and also really ticked off over the fact that the Cleveland Indians have changed their names to the Guardian. So this weekend, fueling the energy, lots fueling the fire. So we should see McCarthy and the Klan come out in full fervor. And I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. I always enjoy a good show, a little bread and circus, a little entertainment. And I hope the Democrats take those moments and highlight the fact that those Republicans were part of the worst day in this country's history. And the stories that they tell and the stories we see, hopefully they grab us and they shake us awake. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about voting. Pennsylvania's done something fun. Can't wait to talk about that. Quick break. Right back.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. That was the day 9,000 copper miners in the Keweenaw region of Upper Peninsula, Michigan, went out on strike. Organized by the Western Federation of Miners, the strike raged on for over 8 months, witnessing devastating tragedy in a Christmas Day fire and ending in bitter defeat. The strike was waged over basic issues like the 8-hour day, higher wages, mine safety, and union recognition. But strikers were also fed up with the company's paternalism and intrusion into their personal lives. They also worried for their jobs with the introduction of labor-saving machinery. The Western Federation of Miners succeeded early on in shutting down the mines, but the copper barons wouldn't budge. By August, many mines reopened with scab labor. Later that month, deputies shot two strikers dead and wounded two others as they returned home from attempting to collect strike benefits. The incident became known as the Sieberville Massacre. Striking miners were absolutely devastated when on Christmas Day, 73, mostly children, were trampled to death during a Christmas party and benefit at the Italian Hall in Calumet. Witnesses remembered seeing a man with a Citizens Alliance button just moments before someone yelled fire that caused the stampede. Soon after the Italian Hall disaster, Western Federation of Miner President Charles Moyer was shot by a Citizens Alliance mob, then loaded, bleeding, onto a train bound for Chicago. By April, the union was broke, the strike was broken, and the miners resolved to return to work. Bosses would only rehire strikers once they had turned in their union cards. The copper mines in the region would finally be organized some 30 years later in a campaign led by Mine Mill during the years 1939 to 1943. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some big fun here in Pennsylvania. And look, not far from where I'm sitting, Fulton County, Pennsylvania. A county that went overwhelmingly for the former guy in the last election. And by overwhelmingly, I mean 85%. 85% of the people in Fulton County voted for Trump. And what their county commissioners and what their leadership in that county decided was a good idea was to hand over their voting machines in some weird kind of unofficial audit. And now the Secretary of State, Veronica DeGraffenried, I can't say her name right, DeGraffenried, she's decertified those machines. And now that county, very small county, going to have to buy new ones. And the Republicans are upset about it. And I'm going, why would you have chosen that county to give those machines away? It makes no sense. Unless there was some voter fraud that went on in there, because all of the voter fraud in this state so far that we found, all Republicans. So just kind of a thought, something to look at. Now, the New York Times has reported that there's an open letter that's gone out to the U.S. Senate from 31 former Senate chiefs of staff. They are urging a reform or repeal of the filibuster. They say that we urge the Senate to choose progress over a procedural rule that has outlived its usefulness. And this seems to be the big call, something that I've said that I'm now in favor of. We need to get some progress. We need to get something done. And maybe this is how we do it. And here to talk a little bit about where we are on the voter front, I've asked Sina Namazi to come talk with us. Sina is the national co-chair of United Students for America, their website, votersoftomorrow.org. Sina, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me today, Rick.
So we're seeing this story coming out that Joe Biden's not doing enough, the administration's not doing enough to push the voting rights bill or the John Lewis bill. I'm curious, where do you guys stand? Where do you guys come down on what's going on?
Sure. Well, to start with that, voting rights is the bedrock of our democracy. Without voting rights, there is nothing else. And that is why it is the most crucial thing that we can dedicate our time to right now. To make something clear, if your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't be trying so hard to take it away. Our vote is our voice and vice versa. So right now we're so focused on just getting a lot of student voices, not only together, but pushing to register across the country. We're seeing so many voter registration laws or voter suppression laws passing, especially in a lot of the southern state legislatures. And our generation is really just focused on putting hope over fear, unity over division, country over party, and doing anything that we can to just get a lot of young people out there and to vote like crazy, because the future of our democracy depends on it.
No, we absolutely need your generation to clean up the mess that my generation helped the generation before me create. We've got a lot to do and in a very short period of time. But again, we seem to have this view, especially by those on the right, that voting is a privilege. It's not a right. In fact, there was just a Pew Research poll that came out, I guess it was yesterday, that shows that amazingly, two-thirds of Republicans think that voting is a privilege that you can limit and not a fundamental right. And that's, to me, that's frightening.
Yeah, I think the problem with a lot of people in office today is they care more about staying in power than they actually do about serving the will of the people, which is why they're trying to silence a lot of voters out there. And I'm telling you, our generation will do whatever it takes to fight that fight. Freedom and democracy aren't free. And obviously it's being taken for granted in our past, but we haven't seen this much unity and division, I don't think, since the Civil War. And I mean, if this is the cause that's gonna define our generation, then so be it, but we're not gonna stop fighting until we show that democracy is the bedrock and we're not gonna lose that fight.
What do you say to the person, Sina, who goes, you know what, let's take the voter ID thing. Which I've been arguing for a long time, is inevitable. I think we've lost the messaging on it. But what do you say, though? What's the big deal about having a photo ID?
Could you phrase your question a little better? Sorry.
There are a number of folks out there who think, something as simple as having a photo ID to vote. What's the big deal about everyone having a photo ID?
Well, I mean, the whole part of it is that it limits people because they purposely make it difficult to get a photo ID in some places, in some of the states. So for example, I still haven't gotten my voter registration card in Texas, and I keep on pushing for it. And if there were an election around the corner, I would have trouble getting registered to vote. And it's different in Texas than it is in Maryland, where I used to live. The whole point of the voter ID law is that it makes it more difficult for Black and Brown communities to get it because there are just more limits in those areas. And especially in poorer areas as well, it's so much harder to get an ID. And it also requires taking off of work and getting on the bus to get your ID, which isn't as convenient as maybe a more wealthy person who can, you know, take the day off or drive. So there are a lot of little things under the radar that are working towards limiting voting that the voter ID kind of symbolizes.
Yeah, because we've seen states across the country, and this is not new. Pennsylvania tried it back in 2011, and it got thrown out in 2012, fortunately. But the messaging for most people, and a lot of Democrats as well, is, you know, what's the big deal? And I've often argued that, you know, maybe one of the things we should mandate it when these laws get passed is make sure that the state is responsible for getting people the documents that they need to be able to register and making it much easier instead of having, as you've said, these incredible barriers for people to get to the elections office that may be only open the second Tuesday of the month for 45 minutes.
Absolutely.
You make it more accessible and more you know, able to get people what they need so that they can do it.
To add on your point, there's no coincidence. I mean, Joe Biden won the election, Georgia and Arizona flipped blue, and now all of a sudden there are these very suppressive voter laws. It's as if they're trying to limit Democrats and some other candidates from winning. It's pretty obvious. And it's a problem, obviously, because as I said at the beginning of our time, that democracy is the bedrock of our nation, of the United States of America. If there's no democracy, there's nothing else. So limiting the will of the people is limiting what our country is about.
And voting is that fundamental building block of the entire thing. If you can't trust what's coming out of the ballot box, then all of it crumbles, which is why, again, I think we do need to have some bit of confidence in what comes out. And it's weird because, you know, the former guy has done everything in his power to discredit what has come out of the ballot box. And yet still, you still find places like in Arizona and like in Michigan where you've got Republicans who are coming out and say, we didn't find anything. There's no there. Just like here in Fulton County, Pennsylvania, there was nothing to find. Yet they went and they ended up screwing themselves over.
Yeah. And I mean, Republicans also won like as well. It's not like Democrats won every single seat in the country. Like Republicans won. So I don't really see how you could say half of a ballot was rigged when like other like members of your party have won. So it is just, you know, I think a lot of rhetoric, obviously. I mean, I hope it doesn't work. It's troubling, but like we're not going to stop at that. We're going to keep going and we're going to keep making sure, and obviously we're focused on young people. We're going to make sure that we turn out a lot of young people in 2022.
From your lips, because you need it. Because 2022 is really an important year, especially where I'm at in Pennsylvania, and I'm hoping that young people come out in huge numbers. But, you know, here's the thing. Republicans trying to stop people from voting is not new. You go back to 1980 when Paul Weyrich was addressing 20,000 Baptist ministers and asked the question, you know, who wants everybody to vote? He goes, I don't want everyone to vote. Our power goes down as the voting populace goes up. So they knew back then you suppress those people from voting, whoever those people are, and increase your numbers, you got a better chance. And you go to 2000, when they kicked a bunch of people off the voting rolls in 2000 for voting while Black, 2004, the caging stuff. Every time you turn around, they're figuring out how to create a new mechanism. Absolutely. To make sure we can't vote.
Absolutely. And I want all the viewers out there to know that history repeats itself. After the 15th Amendment was ratified, a lot of African-American men were winning office. And that's why poll taxes and literacy tests were implemented and other suppressive voting laws. I mean, this is not anything new. I mean, the term is coined Jim Crow 2.0. Because if not slavery, if not police brutality, it's, you know, it's limiting someone's right to the ballot box. And like our democracy is in trouble. Like I want everyone to know that democracy is fragile. And if we don't take care of it and protect it, it is very easy to lose it. Because at this stage right now, the people in elected office are supposed to be working for the people. But right now it's the other way around. And that's not how it's supposed to work.
No, I'm with you. Now, tell me about United Students for America. Tell me about the organization you guys. This is a relatively new group, right?
Yeah. So the original group is Voters of Tomorrow. So United Students of America is kind of is the child of Voters of Tomorrow. Voters of Tomorrow was an organization started in 2019 by Santiago Mayer. He's the director of it. He's been running an amazing job. He's a 19-year-old immigrant from Mexico. And after the 2018 midterms, he realized that there was a lot of disconnect between younger people and elections in general. And I will say that I think a big part of elections is people really rely on young people to turn out and kind of like bolster a lot of the turnout. But I also do realize that there are a lot of disconnects in the resources and the attention provided on the younger generation. So he thought that it would be a great project to kind of build that or bridge that gap, bridge that divide. So USFA, United Students for America, is an organization that I, along with three other students under his overwatch from Voters of Tomorrow, started right in, I believe it was March or April of 2021. So right after the election, all the founders worked for the Biden campaign. We worked on the virtual campaign and led different chapters. So I, for example, led DMV, Students for Biden, DC, Maryland, Virginia, and was also on the Biden Student Leadership Council. And we all found how effective the grassroots organizing was among students across the country that we hadn't even met, but we were all working virtually. And we said, this really worked for 2020. And we actually brought that same network and we implemented the organizing in Georgia for the runoff. And we saw it work very well. We had students from all across the country, not only phone banking and helping people register to vote, but getting them information and getting them to the polls, and turnout was great and everything. And we said, you know what, we got to do this for 2022. And we have basically a national organization, which is what I sit on with three other students. And we basically provide resources in a decentralized manner to students running different groups in swing states across the country, from Texas, Missouri, Florida, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Iowa, Ohio, you name it. And right now they're just focused on civic engagement. So registering voters and such, but once there are pro-democracy candidates on the ballot, we will be doing work to get them elected.
Because, you know, the frame now is coming around is we're not going to get the Voting Rights Act passed through, probably. I'm hoping we get something. Probably not going to get the John Lewis Act. I'm, again, hopeful, not holding my breath. The frame, though, has been coming around. Well, we're just going to have to out-organize them. We're just going to have to pull another rabbit out of another hat. And look, it's part of what you guys are doing, but you can only go to that well so often. And in a non-presidential year, it is much harder to do.
Yeah, it is definitely a lot harder to do, but I guess the messaging that we really have to use is that if we don't do it now, we might not see our healthy democracy ever again. It really is that serious. I want people to understand, like, democracy is on the line. Like, 2020 was probably one of the most consequential elections of our nation's history. And 2022 is right there now because we're seeing voter suppression across the country. So we are really going to have to drive the vote out. But you know what? Like, we're going to do it. I mean, Stacey Abrams did it in Georgia. Everyone's following her lead. She knows what she's doing, and she's really advising everyone else. And credit to all the grassroots organizers who were doing it in 2020. But we're gonna need to multiply that for 2022. But we're going to do it. I mean, we're not going to watch our democracy crumble. We're going to fight the good fight. And,
look,
and
you're going to have to be, and you're going to have to out organize, even just to stay where you are, because as we talked about earlier, you know, there are 30 laws having been passed across this country, putting restrictions on people being able to vote, whether you agree with voter ID, whether you agree with signature verifications or disagree, they're still in place and you're still going to have to figure out how to get over those hurdles.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to figure it out. I mean, young people are not going to let democracy die in darkness. And I know that we are in a time of great disunity, but we're going to keep fighting because that's what this country is about. America is always in the fight for a better opportunity, for more progress, and we're happy to take on that fight, whatever it means.
I love the fact that you're very positive in this, because I have people who are, you know, they're just, oh my God, this is the end of the world. It's all horrible. It's all bad. And the mindset is all negative. Because one of the things I've said is you've got to wake up, you got to put your pants on, get your shoes on, you got to get out in the street, and you got to start fighting. Ball up your digits and start throwing a punch or two. And I'm glad to hear that you're taking this in a very positive direction. If someone wanted to get involved with the work that you're doing, there are a number of college campuses in our listening areas. What would they do?
Well, they could check us out on social media. We have chapters across the country. On Twitter, we are US4America. On our email is UnitedStudentsForAmerica@gmail.com. We have Instagram as well, United Students for America, on Facebook. We're all over. We would love for people to get involved. I mean, the strength of our democracy is in the people. I mean, it's of, by, and for the people. So we need to get everyone involved, and we need everyone to get out to the polls. Even though we saw some of the highest turnout in 2020, we still didn't have as many people as we thought turn out. And that's obviously a problem. As I said, I mean, America, the story of America is that we're always in the fight for a brighter future. And in times that are dark like this, we have to keep on pushing forward, because we see that opportune future, and we're not going to let it get away from us.
Yeah, and it comes back to that, as you pointed out earlier, that direct engagement, that organizing person to person. You know, I have friends who are big digital strategists, and they have ideas and how things are done. I'm going, look, talking to somebody across a table, talking to somebody over a beer, that's still the best way to organize. It's still the best way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's something we got to do more of. But Cena, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Keep up the great work. I hope you'll come back and give us some more information as it's going down the road.
Thank you so much, Rick. And once again, I'm a huge fan of your show. Thank you for the work you do. And thank you for always fighting for the working class people by spreading that good information.
Good stuff. Thanks, Cena. Seema Namazi, he's the national co-chair there of the United Students for America. Check out the website, votersoftomorrow.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day that a mob began an attack on Chinese workers in San Francisco that killed 4 people. During the mid-1870s, a depression swept across the nation. White workers from the East Coast headed west, many to San Francisco, hoping to find a job. Skilled Chinese workers who had completed their labor on the Transcontinental Railroad also came to the city. There, the Chinese laborers found work in trades like cigar making and also open laundries. Resentment against the Chinese workers grew in the city's white working class. In the summer of 1877, workers on the East Coast railroads walked off their jobs after their wages were cut repeatedly. A wave of labor militancy washed over the nation. Historians often refer to that summer as the Great Upheaval, a time where capital and labor literally battled in the streets. In San Francisco, the Workingmen's Association, a socialist workers' organization, called for a rally in front of City Hall. The meeting began with speeches against the titans of capital. But soon, a group of angry workers began to demand speakers, quote, talk about the Chinese. A mob stormed off to terrorize Chinese residents. They burned 20 Chinese laundries. After the violence ended the next day, the anti-Chinese rhetoric continued. An Irish-born freight handler by the name of Dennis Kearney became the vocal leader of the call that the Chinese must go. Adherence to the anti-Chinese cause came to be known as Kearneyism. The backlash against Chinese workers spread beyond California. In 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. Solidarity of workers had fallen to racism. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, workers at the Frito-Lay plant in Topeka, Kansas, they've been on strike since July 5th. And like any strike, it comes down to wages, hours, conditions. And hours being a big part of this. Some of the stories that you've heard of people working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, 84 hours a week for months. Not just on the, you know, hey, occasionally that happens, but week after week after week. You hear stories of the heat, you know, basically wiping people out. And look, we hear these stories a lot. Should we be surprised by them? No, because I talk to people every day who go through stuff like this. The difference is these folks have said no more. We're going to draw a line in the sand. We're hitting the picket line, and we want better. I understand, as we speak, they're voting on a potential agreement, so the strike could end. But from what I'm early indication, I'm not sure, considering the local leadership didn't endorse it. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on out there in Topeka, Kansas, I've asked Alex Press to come talk with us. She's a staff writer with Jacobin Magazine. She's been following this story from the beginning. Alex, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So you see these stories, people working 84 hours a week in these horrible conditions. And my first thought is how has it gotten this bad? Why did you allow it to get to this point? How did it get this bad?
That's a great question. I mean, part of the story, of course, is that some people want some level of overtime, right? People aren't paid enough per hour in this country. A lot of people want to be able to make more money. That itself is a reflection of the pay being too low, which is why, as you mentioned, one of the demands here is for a significant raise, not just 2% a year, which is what the company's offering. So that's part of it. It's also about a union that hasn't been fighting. It's in a right-to-work state. It's incredibly hard to organize new shops and to service the ones that exist. And so that's another part of the story. Frito-Lay is also an incredibly anti-union company. You know, one thing I hadn't realized until I started talking to workers and reporting this story was that, for example, Frito-Lay offers paternity leave for all workers in its non-union shops. The only shops that don't get that are the union shops. Right. So it is punishing workers for having a union. It is trying to get them to decertify their unions and give away the one bargaining chip that they have. So that's part of the story of how it gets here. And I think there's a re-energized local leadership. And I think there's workers who've seen things get so bad that they can't take it anymore during the coronavirus pandemic, where production has been through the roof at this plant. And that all leads up to this explosion where they're voting down proposed contracts and they're finally saying, you know what, we're going on strike.
No, and the thing that's getting me, and the thing that gives me hope as someone who's been a labor guy for years, is that we're seeing more people saying, you know what, we're mad as hell and we're not taking it anymore. We're not going to work 84 hours a week. We're not working for poverty wages in desperate conditions. And we're seeing more people going on strike. And I think that's a good thing.
I think it's a great thing. I mean, conditions have gotten so incredibly bad. You don't have to be a radical to see that workers absolutely need more leverage and more power for the sake of everybody. And so I think, you know, in the case of Topeka, we see what we see all across the country in other industries and other shops, which is that the coronavirus really sort of pushed people over the edge. Things have been so bad for working class people in this country for decades, but they've gotten even worse, right? So in Topeka, workers will talk about how during coronavirus, they watched their managers being able to sit in air-conditioned offices while on the shop floor, the heat was 100 degrees Fahrenheit at 7 in the morning, right? And only got worse in the kitchens. They watched management being able to work from home while they were coming into this production plant when there was coronavirus outbreaks on the shop floor and there were dangerous, hazardous working conditions. And so it's that sort of thing that I think pushes people. And so, yeah, we're seeing it all across all sorts of industries and across the country, but we're definitely seeing it in Topeka as well.
Yeah. And all we keep hearing about is that people whining that there's a labor shortage and that, you know, nobody wants to work anymore, Alex. They're all lazy.
Right. I mean, people, it's interesting how this is playing out at this plant. For example, is, you know, it's about 850 people who work there. And when you talk to them, they say that the company is intentionally understaffing, right? It's not that they would have to offer incredibly high wages to attract people. You know, this plant is paying lower than the various other warehouses in the region. There's a Goodyear plant up the street, for example, that pays better wages. There's all sorts of other options. But Frito-Lay won't budge, right? Because they don't want to outlay more on the benefits and wages and risk that they would have to take by employing people. So instead, they understaff, they force turnover. That's another big part of this story, is that they're trying to get people out the door who have seniority so that they can bring in workers with lower wages and with no benefits. And importantly, workers who don't know what their rights are on the shop floor, who won't demand anything when their rights are violated, say when they're disciplined for something that wasn't their fault, which is another demand that they have in the contract. They want a different disciplinary regime.
No, and all of these things, and especially being a right-to-work state, they wanted that constant churn, so there's no solidarity, which, again, why I think the PRO Act has to pass, how we have to get rid of these insane no-rights-at-work laws that keep people pitted against one another. Because, look, I'm in Pennsylvania, where I fear we're the next no-rights-at-work state in 2023. Something needs to be done. But, the fact that you've highlighted that you've got this division, that's exactly what the employer class wants. They want people pitted against each other so they're not looking at them. And a perfect example of that is Amazon. I mean, you look at what they did in Bessemer, spent $200 million on a campaign that I didn't think they were going to win from the beginning, and did all of the horrible things that you and I both know every employer does. But I think finally people are lifting their heads and being aware of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon is a great example. It's obviously what I spend most of my time writing and talking about. And it's exactly that. It's about, can you lower expectations enough among workers and make them see each other as competing, opponents in a war for scarcity, right? And Amazon did that in Bessemer. It did it with an anti-union campaign, and also threatened and scared people by saying, if you demand better, you couldn't possibly win. All you'll do is close this warehouse, right? We'll move elsewhere. We'll give up here. And so you make it so that workers don't feel they have any other options but to turn against one another. I mean, this was really illustrated in Bessemer in this anecdote about how there was a jail nearby. And so often there were people who had records who were having trouble getting jobs, and Amazon, during the union vote, would bring those workers on. They weren't eligible to be in the bargaining unit, to be in the union, and they would outfit them with swag. They would walk around on the shop floor in the warehouse with vote no pins, and they would be a human embodiment of the war that employers are waging, where they pit workers who have even less rights than those who might be in unions against one another, right? And the only result is discord and weakness for everyone.
Yeah, as one person we had on talk about it said that basically the old school sandwich boards, you had all these people who couldn't get jobs, and they outfitted them with old school sandwich boards to continue to send that anti-union message in a place where I didn't even think they really had to, because again, Alabama is another one of these no rights at work states where you didn't have to join the union anyway. And it's incredible to me that Amazon would have put up that kind of a fight. Other than it's really about power and control and nothing else.
It always is. I mean, this is the one thing that I feel like when people start reading about a union fight or the labor movement, they really don't understand. Why would a company spend so much money on something that often wouldn't cost them that much? A union, maybe, that might get a little bit of a higher raise, but it's so about control, right? Amazon's entire business model relies on absolute domination, a dictatorship in the workplace that you can hire and fire at will, that no one has the right to speak back or say no or demand anything better. And, that's the flexibility that everyone loves about Amazon, is that actually workers are pushed and pulled to the breaking point. And again, that is exactly what's going on in Topeka. I mean, workers here, as you said, when you introduced this story, are literally dying. People have had heart attacks on the shop floor, and they allege that Frito-Lay told them to basically move the body and keep working. People speak about suicide regularly in a way that takes no prodding at all. And people also talk about divorces and general sort of discord at home. Because again, imagine if your spouse is working 84 hours a week, he's not taking care of the kids. There's going to be problems if that's what's happening. And yeah. So again, this is really a life and death matter.
No, it is. And this is not just in Kansas. This is in states all across the country. Because I remember, when I first entered the workforce some 30 years ago, those were prime jobs. Those were good union jobs. Those were family sustaining wage jobs. And you hear how far they've fallen because the pendulum of power has moved to the employer. You're talking about back to desperation wages.
Right. I mean, that is what is happening here. It's an obviously extreme example, what's happening with the hours at Topeka. But across the board, it's true that workers have increasingly lost the little bit of leverage that they had on the shop floor and at the legal level. This is part of what the argument for the PRO Act is that also has to change at the legal level of labor law. But the result is just there's no one having any leverage at all, and employers are doing as they please. I mean, one worker I spoke to in Topeka, I asked him, did he think that the company treats the machinery better than it treats the workers? And he said yes. And I think that applies. That is a feeling certainly that Amazon workers voice all the time, that they're treated like robots, that in fact they are treated worse than Amazon's robots. And so I think that is a generalized sentiment where employers have divested themselves of any sense that they have to care for their workers. In fact, they're just using them and throwing them away.
Yeah, but now, you know, talking about Amazon, they're spending tons of money on PR, and I'm sure you see this more than anyone, telling how wonderful they are, how they give college money, how they create all these wonderful jobs. And I'm going, but you know, here's the thing. I remember warehouse jobs back when I first started working. In today's dollars, we're paying almost double what you're paying with better benefits and much better working conditions. Sorry, I'm not buying.
Yeah, I mean, this is the trick that unfortunately a lot of journalists fall for in mainstream media. Even now, after they've seen, you know, years of Amazon workers complaining about this, they compare Amazon to, say, a fast food restaurant. And they say, well, if the starting wage is $15 an hour, that's pretty good. That's better than $7.25, the federal minimum. But in fact, this is not that industry. This is the warehousing industry. And there, Amazon is paying even now below the average for union or non-union wages. They're paying below the industry standard. In fact, studies show that when Amazon opens up a facility in a county, it brings down the wages at the other facilities too, right? It's so big that it actually sets the terms of labor relations, both in their industry and across the country in other industries as well.
Yeah, it's again, you know, and we've given them that power. You know, if you watch, and I know I'm sure you paid attention to the fight for H2Q and all of the information that cities and local municipalities just handed over to Amazon in the hopes of landing one of these headquarters, which you knew they were never getting, but they did all this free work for Amazon that evidently we're still, as taxpayers, not allowed to see.
Yeah, I mean, this was a big part of that. That was obviously a circus, right? I mean, I've described it as, you know, Amazon said jump and every elected official in the country said, okay, how high? Say for maybe two or three people. But they got, you know, in that process, not only did they get to demonstrate their power, they got data, which they rely on. That is a key thing that Amazon needs. It's not just labor power, it's also data. And they got that information from so many counties and regions across the country, which even if they were never going to pick those areas, they now have intimate knowledge of what they should and shouldn't do in those areas going forward. As well as they got to humiliate everyone and show just how weak working class people have gotten at this point.
Boy, you are so right on that. Now, in the last Teamsters convention, in their 30th convention, just wrapped up a couple weeks ago, the Teamsters have come out and said that they're going to put a big push into organizing Amazon, especially their drivers, because ultimately UPS's future is on the line here. If Amazon creates a major competitor, UPS is pretty much done. Do you think it's something possible? I mean, the Teamsters Union is a good size union, about 1.4 million members across the country. Given our labor law situation, given the situation that we are in this country, you think that can happen?
I think it has to happen. I mean, when it will happen is a different question. But I mean, for me, the Teamsters jumping into this fight in a sustained way with such a sort of grand vote in this setting up of an Amazon division and putting real resources is absolutely a good thing. You know, the devil's in the details, of course, with any union, including the Teamsters, as far as how that's implemented. But at the end of the day, I mean, the power Amazon has and the way that labor law and the politicians and everything else are stacked against workers at every level of the process of unionizing and winning better wages means that we need every single union. We need everybody involved in the fight. And so I think it's absolutely a good thing. And, you know, I've talked to Teamsters at the rank and file level who've been through these trainings that the Teamsters are putting on that are getting them ready to organize in the Amazon division. And, you know, they're tentatively hopeful. They say that it's serious, that people are actually taking this very seriously, not just out of self-interest, but also the sense that, you know, if you let Amazon carry on in its way, then it's going to control everything. That is the goal, right? I mean, Jeff Bezos just this week was talking about how he can't wait to colonize space. And he was just visiting to check it out before he moves industry up there. So I think the writing is very clear that every union should absolutely be getting involved in trying to win this fight. You know, whether it's going to happen in the next 5 years, I certainly hope so. I'm doing my best to try to help. But, you know, open question for sure.
Yeah, I've been a Teamster for over 30 years, and I've been saying for 30 years, we need to be doing this stuff more because I lived through what was the downfall of the LTL trucking industry after Carter signed deregulation. And, you know, when I started in the LTL industry, it was 85% unionized. Today, it's down to about 10%. And we've lost significant bargaining power for wages, hours, conditions, and things are really sliding backwards. But even that, you know, our industry is still far way above everyone else because they've been left behind. So I'm really hoping these organizing and these training sessions do bring people in and make us a much more militant working class.
Right. I mean, that is, at the end of the day, the least that needs to happen, right? Whether Amazon can be taken over or not, you know, can actually be unionized, can actually be forced to change its ways, open question. But regardless, you know, the effort has to happen that we actually are creating more militant, more democratic, efforts to organize working class people, because, you know, after the pandemic, as you've said, you know, there's rage, there's outrage, there's strikes, actions and walkouts, but there's also incredible disorganization and alienation as people have been isolated more than ever over the past year and have actually been further turned against each other. And so, again, I think efforts like this, and it's part of why I focus on Amazon, is in fact, you know, when Amazon provides this opportunity of, you know, in fact, it's brought us all under its roof. We're all in a way a part of Amazon's empire. That is an opportunity too.
Yeah. And you obviously have just started a new podcast, the Primer Podcast. You can follow you at Primer Pod. Tell me a little bit about the new podcast.
Yeah. So, you know, I think as anyone listening to this would get a sense, it's very hard to keep track of everything that's going on at Amazon. You know, it touches everything. There's so many different arms. It's both the warehouses, but also the infrastructure of the internet and also all these sort of side projects. It's entering new markets, healthcare, facial technology, recognition technology. And so Primer is just an attempt to sort of be an opening for people who are curious about this information, don't want to keep up with it, and want to learn some basic things about Amazon's business model. So we're doing, you know, episodes that are focused on labor and lots of interviews with workers from both across the United States and also around the world at other Amazon facilities, but also trying to take things a piece at a time. So there's an episode about what is Amazon's finance model? There'll be one about the steel industry and how was it organized? And then how is that relevant to today? There'll be one that compares it to Walmart, right? So trying to make this extremely far-reaching and complicated subject something that's accessible and that you could say, send your friend or your relative and say, hey, check this out. There's an interview with Amazon workers this week.
I hope people will check it out. We'll get links on social media, how people can take a look at it. I think it's important. I want to go back to the Frito-Lay thing in Kansas. The vote, obviously, tonight. Any expectations? Any thoughts?
I really don't know how it's going to go. It's, you know, it'll be decided, I think, announced by midnight tonight. But, you know, the local leadership, as you mentioned, is not recommending that it's accepted. Right. And so that does signal something. Certainly, I've seen the leaked sort of amendments that are being put in place. The famous suicide shifts that got a lot of attention, those are going to be out. But the amendment still includes the fact that workers may be forced to work, you know, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. And it's even unclear if they'll get that seventh day off. So among other things, that's an issue, right? Wages also are still a live issue. And so, you know, I wouldn't dare to tell a worker how to vote, but I would say that it's not certain it's going
to
pass.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. But Alex, I appreciate you taking time for us. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again soon.
Yeah, happy to come anytime.
Good
Thank
stuff.
You.
Good stuff. Alex Press, staff writer there at Jacobin Magazine. Make sure you check out the work that they do over there. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1892. That was the day that Lithuanian-born anarchist Alexander Berkman attempted to shoot steel magnate Andrew Carnegie's second-in-command, Henry Clay Frick. Berkman wanted to avenge the Homestead Steel Massacre, in which 9 workers were killed. Berkman's lover, Emma Goldman, wrote in her autobiography, "Frick is the responsible factor in this crime." She went on to write that Berkman had told her, "I will kill Frick, and of course, I shall be condemned to death. I will die proudly in the assurance that I gave my life for the people, but I will die by my own hand. Never will I permit our enemies to kill us." Alexander Berkman went to Frick's office on July 21st, posing as a New York City hiring agency representative. When Berkman was told Frick could not see him, he left. He returned 2 days later. He burst into Frick's office and fired 2 shots at Frick's head. Several of Frick's associates were able to wrestle him to the ground. Still, Berkman managed to take out the sharpened steel file he was carrying and stab Frick twice. Despite all of this, Frick did not die. Berkman was in jail for 2 months awaiting trial. Alexander Berkman was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced to 27 years in prison. He served 14 years of his term before being released. Berkman wrote an account of his prison years titled Prison Memoirs of an Anarchist. In 1917, he and Emma Goldman were arrested and found guilty of violating the Espionage Act, and both were imprisoned for 2 years. In 1918, both were deported from the United States.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.